Okay, so really glad to have Antoine Busquet with me this morning to talk about The Eye of War, his fascinating book on military targeting, sensing, and imaging. And just a little bit of background about Antoine. He's an associate professor at the Swedish Defence University in Stockholm. He's the author of The Eye of War, Military Perception from the Telescope to the Drone, which we're going to be discussing today. He's also the author of The Scientific Way of Warfare, Order and Chaos on the Battlefields of Modernity. And he's contributed to an array of peer-reviewed articles and book chapters on subjects that include nuclear war, the revolution in military affairs, jihadist networks, complexity theory, violent aesthetics, nihilism, and the conceptualization of war. And I really would just check out Antoine's recent articles that are online. Just the titles alone, Kaoplexy, etc., sound fascinating. But today we're going to be focusing on the Eye of War.
Thanks for having me, James.
Thank you. So, just to get straight into the first question, so what does the Eye of War refer to within the context of your book?
Right, so the book, as the title of the book, gestures at the monograph is tries to provide an account of military perception, vision, perhaps in the first instance, although vision in a way is just the most important of the senses, perhaps, and range exceeds mere vision. But the underlying kind of interrogation of the book is to understand the con what I think is a contemporary condition of global targeting. That is to say, the fact that we, by and large, exist in a world today where anything that can be perceived around the globe can be geolocated and can be targeted with lethal force. That's quite a remarkable development, and one that must surely have significant ramifications for war and security. And so, this alignment, of perception of this and destruction—that what you can see, you can destroy—is at the heart of the book. And the intention was to provide something like a socio-technical genealogy, or maybe a machining history of the present. How have we got there? What are the various techniques, knowledges, rationalities that have led to that capability, and what are its implications? So that led me to then try and unpack what Paul Virilio has called the logistics of perception in that wonderful phrase, and to break it down into, I think, three core functional constituents of sensing, imaging, and mapping. Sensing being the activities that gather perception, and order it. Imaging that records and distributes those sense perceptions, further interprets them for action, and mapping, which has to do with the location or geopositioning of those images or those representations of sense perception. And so all of these are quite entangled techniques, but we can nonetheless, I think, formally distinguish them. So the book kind of proceeds according broadly to that structure. But there's also kind of a second, more muted, more implicit referenced in the title, a kind of wordplay, if you want, or pun, which is that we can think of the eye of war as I being the subject of war. And that touches onto, I think, what there's a secondary theme within the book, which is the question of agency in war. Since what the overarching narrative of the book is this increasing automation, technologization, and ultimately perhaps autonomization of perception, such that the question of agency, the question of who the central actor in war is, which we've typically, of course, throughout history thought of as the human, comes increasingly into question. So there is also that underlying theme that's reflected in the title.
Great, and that theme of agency is certainly something we're going to return to in later questions. A really fascinating and rich book, charting that history as you've mentioned. Something that particularly caught my eye was, to lead into the next question, how did the development of linear perspective during the Renaissance give rise to the modern military technologies of sensing, targeting, and mapping?
So the kind of approach I took to the subject matter, and I suppose it's also a general method to the book, which was to try and, if I've got to produce some kind of history, to try and trace it back as far as I possibly could. Not because I think there's necessarily a single origin or moment that from which everything would unfold, but that there's value in kind of trying to seek the kind of earliest antecedents of the present. In many cases, it's because I think we also in that way, first of all, appreciate how some of the contemporary developments are actually a very long tail of developments that have taken place over several centuries. But also when we return to some early kind of more primitive instantiations of these principles, sometimes, you know, in ways that are quite incorrect or fallible, it draws out, I think, more clearly what these underlying mechanisms are. Which is why throughout the book I kind of looked at some of a variety of systems, quite primitive systems, some of which sound kind of a bit crazy or were very kind of a marginalia, really, not fundamentally revolutionary systems. But what we can see is that they serve as precedents, antecedents to what would come earlier. So in terms of kind of where to start the whole story, I ended up going back to the early modern period, or more precisely the Renaissance. I think it starts there partly because, of course, the story is heavily infused with scientific rationality. And of course, it is the dawn of modern scientific investigation. But also we find a kind of cultural phenomenon and during which we kind of see encapsulated all the fundamental principles that I end up developing throughout the book. And that period is, or that cultural moment is that of the Renaissance, more precisely the Quattrocento in Italy, and the development of what became known as linear perspective. And I think it's an interesting point to start with, because the connection between linear perspective and war is not necessarily inherently obvious. Of course, it throughout, you know, in our histories of art and so forth, linear perspective is a very important moment, kind of birth of the modern art form, an art form that still to this day we still consider to be some of the masterpieces of European culture, the paintings of your Michelangelo's and so forth. But what we see is this development of a technique that represents depth perspective, that gives us images that suddenly look like there are a window into which we are looking through. But beyond the kind of artistic importance of these images, of course, they were imbued with religious resonance and so forth. When we think about and when we examine the techniques that went into the construction of these images, actually, we start pulling at a thread that draws in many, many different activities of the period. It ties into activities of land surveying. It ties into principles of early scientific cartography. And what really holds all these things together is an underlying process, intertwined rationalization of vision and mathematization of space. These two things kind of proceed together through in that early moment. So more precisely, what is at stake here? What are these techniques? What are these knowledges? Well, I think there's kind of three sets of them. They're all, as I say, entangled with one another, but distinguishable nonetheless. The first being that we see in this period the development of a geometric understanding of vision. An understanding of how the eye actually measures perception or depth, how we our eyes and our brains effectively allow us to construct some sense of the size, relative size of objects, the dispositions of objects in space and so forth. And that becomes appropriated through geometric principles, and particularly like through fairly basic trigonometry, to allow for the measurement of space by eye. So, you know, go back to your basic trigonometry. If you have a triangle of which you know one of the base, and then you know the angles to that base towards the point towards the third position, you can reconstruct the distance to that position. And so this became very important for land surveying. So measuring distances measuring positions and lengths at distances, but also, of course, in the development of artillery, which in this period is coming into its own, allowing artillery operators to get a sense of how far the targets are, to adjust their weapon systems accordingly. So that's the first kind of activity. The second activity is what we most associate with linear perspective, which is this construction of images that are optically convincing. Now, this was an art form, but it was also a heavily rule-governed art form. There were very specific rules that you had to apply in order to do this. It wasn't just kind of intuitive. It had to be done according to very strict procedures for it to work, for it to conform to what the human eye naturally follows in terms of detecting objects and getting a sense of perception and depth. And then finally, there's a set of techniques that evolve around the geometric projection of three-dimensional space onto two-dimensional surfaces. This obviously applies to linear paintings. How do you make a flat surface look like it has depth? But these techniques also are very important for the development of cartography. Obviously, when you draw, you're producing a world map. And again, this is a period that's associated also with the age of discovery by the European world. And of course, all these maps are being produced to understand what are these new spaces that we're occupying, how we navigate between them. And when we map the world, we're obviously mapping a globe onto a flat surface. So some understanding of the underlying mathematics allows you to make much more accurate and reliable maps than what we produced previously. So we have all these things kind of tied together in linear perspective. What becomes, I think, particularly significant as well for the rest of the story is precisely because all these activities are rule governed, are subject to kind of mathematical principles. They all allow for some degree or a process of incremental technological automation. And from very early on, perspective painters had tools to help them produce these images. You know, not all of them could be expert mathematicians, so various kinds of painting aids were developed to allow them to produce images without having to necessarily apply all the underlying mathematics. And that really is just the kind of thin edge of the wedge, because there's a whole series of systems that are developed to automate various activities. So we can think of the role of rangefinders, devices that allow you to, simply by looking at a distant object, read off the distance of it from this elongated tube, which basically acts as the basis of your surveying kind of triangle. Or another way of thinking about this process of automation is the kind of incremental development of techniques for the automation of perspectival images, which leads ultimately to photography. So that photography can be understood as a several century long effort to produce perspectival images automatically. So again, we go back to linear perspective, which is quite remote, of course, from our present time. But what we find in it is a set of ideas and a set of principles and a set of objectives that would continue to unfold in the centuries beyond and provide a kind of conceptual basis for understanding how perspective, and ultimately how targeting and mapping operate in the contemporary present, even when these techniques are not necessarily applied in contemporary systems. So ranging can now use with laser guidance, that's all laser ranges, which operate under different principles, but the underlying motives, the underlying objectives are the same. And there is this kind of internal coherence, a set of principles that we can pull at and we can try and bring to the surface.
Yes, and while you were talking there, Antoine, I was reminded, I've recently been reading Plato's Republic. And you mentioned this as well in your book. You go further back to the ancient Greeks and some of the techniques that they had for sort of proto-linear linear perspective. And even in Plato's Republic, Plato talks about the good being akin to the line, the straight line. So there's even a kind of a seed of that leading through there. But leaning back to, you know, your comments just there about laser guidance and photography, it seems that one of the key themes of your book is that sort of harnessing of light towards an ever greater precision. And, you know, you talk a lot about the laser as kind of being an end goal of that. So leading into the next question, by marshalling photons into a lethal beam, does the laser represent a fulfillment of the martial gaze, that Gorgon stare that at once completes the, quote, alignment of perspective with annihilation, while threatening to blind the very eye that gave rise to it?
So, yes, to kind of make sense of that, I think I need to kind of take a few steps back and try to kind of narrate how we get to the point at which the laser might be seen as the culmination of a certain development. This kind of fits in the chapter that is entitled Sensing, and deals with the ways in which targeting has developed over the course of several centuries. And I propose four orders of targeting, four kind of ways in which the entangling of perception and targeting have become ever more sophisticated. The first of these orders is simply that of aiming, and that actually is a very basic one, and, you know, traced back all the way to, you know, the first humans who threw spears or objects and who basically aligned line of sight with line of fire, roughly speaking. You look at something and you throw something at it, and that's kind of the underlying principle of a basic firearm, and, you know, this can be supplemented or has been supplemented with ways of extending vision through telescopic sights and things of that nature, but that constitutes kind of the basic alignment of the eye with the weapon. Then we get to kind of techniques of ranging, which come into being when you are trying to fire weapons at great distances, and where it's simply not the case that you can align line of sight with line of fire, because the trajectory of the weapon system will be parabolic in order to reach kind of a long distance. There can be like a slight parabola, of course, with kind of shorter range weapons, but that can be something that's kind of largely intuited. When you get to artillery, that's something you actually have to be worked out on a much more systematic basis. And that's where, you know, those ranging techniques, those surveying techniques that I've talked about a moment ago, kind of come into play. You start using, you continue to use vision, and you continue to use aiming in a sense, because you have to align your vision with the object you're looking at. But instead of having a single position from which you sight the target, you will need two of them, and then you will apply those kind of basic trigonometric principles to obtain an estimation, a calculation of the range of the target, and then based on what you know about the properties of your weapon system, you will be able to configure it so that hopefully you can reach the target. So that's a kind of second order of ranging. And ranging, of course, became very important in the First World War, and where as a war artillery, knowing the distance, your position to another system, to another target, and so forth. But the problem kind of arises already in the late 19th century when you're dealing with mobile targets, whereby locating positions or targeting positions in space is insufficient because there is a temporal dimension, and the ranges are such that by the time your weapon system arrives at the destination, that target will have moved. Now, this problem came first into focus in naval warfare, where obviously you're navigating on the seas, which are kind of mobile, but also the cannons of the late 19th century in the naval context, extremely powerful, great distances. So suddenly you need to actually be targeting no longer in space, but in space-time. You need to start estimating where the target is going to be. So ranging is still important, but it's on its own insufficient. Or rather, you need to supplement range measurements with more range measurements. You need like a series of range measurements that give you a trajectory, and on the basis of which you start making a prediction about the future. You track basically the target, and then you compute some future position estimation of where that target will be, and that's the position that you aim at. So very early kind of computational techniques and early computing systems really start developing in the late 19th century for this very purpose. We see this again in naval warfare to begin. And it's a problem that then becomes only more important in the mid-20th century with anti-aircraft fire. Now you're dealing with aircraft that you're having to try and shoot down. They move a lot faster, the distances are much greater. So the problems become even greater, and that creates further pressure to automate these calculations. And we see early electronic computers developed for that purpose, precisely because they can calculate faster than the early mechanical systems. So that's a kind of order of tracking. Tracking kind of relies on, it's quite a feat to kind of achieve, but fundamentally in the end, tracking could never be the entire solution for it, because the imponderables in trying to predict the future in this way turned out to be too great, particularly in the anti-aircraft case. So that kind of gives rise to a final order of targeting, which is the order of guiding, where effectively what you do is you take the system of tracking, but you embed it into the actual projectile, so that the tracking is continuing until the very moment of impact. So that's most obviously embodied in a self-guided missile, which is will be continuously tracking its target until it closes the distances with it and successfully impacts the target. So what these orders of targeting show is kind of, again, this increasing sophisticated interlinkage between perception and targeting, and in a way in which each of the order kind of becomes embedded in the following one, right? So they don't simply replace one another, they kind of embed themselves. So that kind of then leads us to, I mean, first of all, one thing to say is that this order of targeting can be thought of as operating in the first instance in the visual spectrum. We're thinking about optical targeting, if you want, but of course throughout the 20th century, what we've seen is the range of the electromagnetic spectrum widen, so that a lot of targeting, a lot of tracking, and so forth takes place within radar frequencies, within the infrared realm, and so forth. But the basic principles still apply. And then, the case of laser, which you kind of invoked in your question, is, I think, very kind of telling in a way, because laser is its own thing in a sense, right? It is the kind of stimulated emission of photons. It's light itself that is channeled in a very narrow beam. And laser has kind of quite remarkable properties that allow it to support all these orders of targeting. You can have laser sights, which allow you to aim with greater precision. You can use laser very effectively for ranging. In fact, it's an incredibly precise means of ranging. You know the speed of the laser, which is basically the speed of light. You can receive the reflections from it and get very precise, accurate readings in this way. You can obviously use it for tracking, as we see, or guidance in the case of laser-guided missiles and so forth. So in that sense, it might just seem like just another tool in these four orders of targeting. But it also has a very unique property, which is that lasers are potentially a weapon themselves. And militaries for the last 40, 50 years have been pursuing laser weapons with great persistence and at great expense, because it's kind of a fantasy weapon in a way, of course. Our science fiction is full of laser weapons, and lasers have, quite remarkable properties. Obviously, they travel extremely fast, what's striking about them is that they kind of, you see in the laser this ultimate convergence of light with destruction, right? Where the light itself becomes the weapon. Now, the kind of laser weapons that we associate with science fiction haven't really materialized to date. The technological obstacles turn out to be quite significant. Huge amounts of energy you actually use. So we don't really have very many deployed laser weapons. But perhaps the kind of most kind of effective area of application, which is perhaps revealing, is that the laser is actually a very good blinding weapon. That our human eye, which is at the very beginning of this story, right? This is the eye is what allows these orders of targeting to develop, the human eye, is in fact uniquely especially vulnerable to laser. So if you shoot the laser into someone's eyes, you have a good chance of doing them serious damage. And some blinding weapons have been developed. Few have been deployed because they're generally thought to be in violation of the laws of war. But they kind of maybe reveal something about where we stand in this story, that as humans, we've initiated this process and we end up with weapons that seem best at this point suited to depriving us of our vision and supplanting us.
Antoine, I'm really enjoying the way that you're sort of building your answers right back from basics up to the point there. And again, just a few points there. The laser, I'm reminded of my own PhD thesis on ballistic missile defense. And again, in your book, you talk about one of my favorite technologies since abandoned, the airborne laser. And again, I'm reminded of the problems that the US Air Force had with that, was basically that they were putting these airborne lasers on these giant converted aircraft, but the amount of battery power that was needed to power this laser was just so heavy that it wasn't very economical. And also, one of the big problems was the fact that if you had a cloudy day, that greatly dispersed the power of the laser. And also, because they shoot in a straight line, you can't fire below the horizon, at least from the airborne laser. And that was one of the reasons why they eventually ended up abandoning that program.
Laser weapons are a little bit like nuclear fusion. They're always like just around the corner, and then somehow they don't materialize. But who knows when and if they will materialize. But what I think my kind of study kind of shows is that some technologies can be, you know, really a bit of a joke for a long time, or can the development can be a matter of centuries until they realize. But what you can see early on is the underlying reason and motivation and logic of why these systems are desirable, right? And why it's likely that we will keep pushing at them until perhaps they actually do materialize.
And also I'm just reminded of, talking about blinding of the eyes, a real local news report recently whereby a gentleman was arrested for trying to shine a laser in a police helicopter's eyes, and his defence in court was that it wasn't him, it was a UFO. Obviously, that didn't stand up in court, but, you know, just a bit of a funny point there. Okay, so moving on from lasers a little bit, you bring up, Jorge Luis Borges, and his famous infamous essay around the map is not the territory. But I wondered, you spend a lot of time talking about mapping in your book. Contra Borges, with the rise of digitized mapping and geographic information systems, GIS, can the map now exceed the territory?
Mm-hmm. So yes, you're referring here to Borges' kind of famous short story entitled On Exactitude in Science, where, you know, he describes, he gives us a story of an emperor who asks or demands that his territories be mapped with most accuracy. And so the scholars set out and produced this one-to-one map of the world, and they end up producing a map that effectively overlays the territory. And by virtue of overlaying the territory, it becomes an utterly useless map. And so it just kind of decays. That's the kind of lesson of the story, which is perhaps seen in this way, that science has to be in some ways inexact, that it has to involve some reduction, some simplification. That a one-to-one map is useless. But in order to kind of explain why I think that story might need to be revisited, I think I have to say a few things about mapping before that. The kind of important starting point for the way I deal with maps in the book is that I treat maps as a cognitive technology, as something that is not just a representation of space, but is actually a way, a way by which we outsource or interact on a cognitive level with space through the medium of the map. So, you know, a good example of this, and I think this is obviously particularly the case with the development of scientific mapping. You look at the Mercator map, the famous Mercator map developed in the early modern period, and you know, that has given us the shapes of the continents, the proportions of the continents in the ways that we're most associated, we're most familiar with today. And of course, this is kind of a representation that's been critiqued in various ways for being Eurocentric, by placing Europe at the center, for involving some distortions, which make the northern hemisphere look bigger than, say, the countries near the equator. So, for example, Africa looks a lot smaller than it is in actual fact, at least proportionally to Europe. But I think that's absolutely valid. I mean, whatever projection you do from a 3D globe to a 2D map, you will get some form of distortion. So you basically have to choose which kinds of distortions you want. And I think it's valid to say that certain distortions might have certain kind of connotations, which we might want to resist. But at the same time, it was really important to understand that Mercator chose the particular projection that he did, at least in large part, because it allowed for him to draw courses of constant bearing as straight lines. And that's incredibly important in the era of navigation and illustrates the point I'm making about maps as cognitive technologies. What this Mercator map allowed was navigators to say, okay, we want to go to this position on Earth, on the globe, and so we can simply draw a line, a straight line on a map that will be correspond to a line of constant bearing. So we don't have to translate the map into our navigational instructions. So when we then kind of think more broadly about the kind of role of maps in warfare, now for the largest period, of course, maps have been very useful for navigation, for conquest and so forth, moving troops into unfamiliar territories. Again, of course, the Mercator map is tied into all that history of imperialism and colonialism. But it's not really until the 19th century that the map starts to have a role in battle itself. Right? Maps would be used to bring troops to positions and so forth, but actually on the battlefield, maps were largely irrelevant until the Napoleonic Wars, really. Napoleon is kind of an important kind of pioneer in this. And from then on, it becomes more and more significant. And particularly, again, as the map becomes a more sophisticated cognitive technology. You can see this, for example, in the First World War, which on the Western Front produces these huge static fronts, whereby, and a war again of artillery, where mapping becomes really very important. That's why you see aerial photography also developing greatly at this point, and a tremendous mapping activity, which tries to keep up to date the positions of the enemy, and to use these maps as the means to instruct artillery fire. So this leads to these techniques of map shooting, where you basically artillery units can just read coordinates off maps and translate them into instructions for firing artillery. It leads to kind of very sophisticated kind of tactical schemes, such as rolling barrages, where you kind of incrementally fire lines of artillery with troops advancing behind it and so forth. This is where the map kind of becomes a very important kind of tactical aid at this period. And this will develop further in the 20th century, notably with the Cold War and the project for intercontinental nuclear war, basically, where you're sending ballistic missiles across the world and you're going to need maps that are now globalized maps. So this kind of drives the project of geodesy in the second half of the 20th century. It's a project that's actually really fascinating and is really shrouded in secrecy. I could only find so much work on that when I did look into it. Most of this is basically military research that was driven by the United States in large part to allow for it to get very precise scientific measurements of the size of the globe, so that maps would overlay perfectly over what is not, you know, a perfect globe. So all of this kind of, you know, leads to this period, to this kind of condition where we have kind of a global architecture of address. We basically can position anything that we see on the globe in a very accurate terms, and therefore we can target it also with tremendous accuracy. Now, in terms of the kind of quote that you and the reference to Borges, I think this is ties into another development that occurs in the second half of the 20th century, which is a kind of progressive digitization of the map, which leads to what's known as a geographic information system. Now, this is really a very fundamental shift in our understanding of the map. The map basically becomes then conceived as an information system. In a way, when I say, oh, the map is a cognitive technology, I'm able to say this because I live with, you know, I'm thinking in a world where maps are already understood as information systems. So I think it's part of a period where map makers start understanding reflexively what maps actually were all along, which I think early cartographers had a very limited understanding of. That's tied into a kind of the development of an informational episteme or other kinds of understandings of cognition and information that developed in this period. But fundamentally, to kind of simplify it all, what has occurred in the last 3 or 4 decades is that maps no longer are what we traditionally think of them as, which is basically these mostly paper representations that are static or punctuated representations of space. So, you know, you have a map, it's been made by a cartographer at a particular point in time, and you have to work with that. Maybe you can scribble on it and add a bit of information, but effectively the representation is fixed at a particular time, and it's what is represented in that map is entirely decided by the cartographer. Contrast this with where we are now, where maps are in fact merely dynamic, often generally interactive visualizations of constantly updated geographic databases. So just think about your maps on your smartphones. What you have is a dynamic visualization of wherever you are, wherever you want to go, and it's constantly being updated by the servers in the background and the information that's being plugged into it. And you, as the user, get to choose what you want to see. Maybe you're looking for restaurants, maybe you're looking for the nearest train station, or whatever it might be. Your purpose, your function, your goal is going to be directing the kind of information that you're going to draw out of the system. And this, of course, applies to military information systems as well, where, again, maps are now these constantly updated dynamic systems where the cognitive operations are very explicit, right, in the sense that the user is no longer a kind of a passive recipient of the map, but is an active producer of the map, shapes the map, adds information into the map, and so forth. So when we come down to kind of to Borges's story, you know, Borges had in mind this kind of static map, right? This paper map that would just overlay the world in this kind of rigid fashion. And what use would that be? It would just be kind of a pale simulacrum of the territory, and moreover, designed at a particular time, not able to evolve with the actual changes of the territory. What we actually inhabit today increasingly is a correspondence between territory and map. So it's not even the case that the map has supplanted or exceeded the territories, as you put it, but rather that they coexist together. And the territory is constantly kind of informing the map, because the map is this kind of dynamic representation of the territory, but the map is also allowing us to navigate and control and potentially dominate the territory. And there's all sorts of applications. You can see this. If you think about self-driving cars, you know, one of the ways in which self-driving cars are trying to be brought to market is by having these cars effectively navigate some kind of virtual environment that is mapped on a one-to-one with the territory, that allows the car to draw both on kind of repositories of data that it's fed on, as well as an ability to respond dynamically to its environment. Another way of thinking where we're going is by reference to augmented reality. Apple has just recently released its own kind of augmented reality / virtual reality headset. And augmented reality is very interesting because what it Promises is a navigation of reality through which we can see the real world, but overlaid over it is all this information, contextual information we might want. Or maybe we're checking our emails, but maybe we're also navigating this virtual map that is pointing us to features in our immediate space that are relevant to us. And so, again, relative to Borges, it's not that the kind of this one-to-one map is useless. Quite the opposite. This one-to-one map is now almost indistinguishable from the territory itself. Both need to kind of coexist in a shape in a way, but they become also in some sense indistinguishable or indeterminate.
Thanks, Antoine. Great answer. And again, just to reach back a little bit, maps and territories, lasers. I'm not sure if I'm using quite the right term, but I wonder if you've seen footage from recent years whereby I believe it's the US Army and they're using a kind of infrared system, and I believe it might be LIDAR or something like that, where they've got really, really, it looks so incredibly crisp. They've got sort of outlines around all the sort of buildings and people, but it's infrared, it's at night time. And just the incredible clarity that gives to the area these soldiers are in. You know, if we're talking about the map interacting with the territory, just would seem it would make that so much more easy to operate at night than traditional infrared.
So, you know, any map is ultimately a simplification of reality because it's a choice, right, as to what you represent and what you don't represent. You know, traditional map makers would have to make determinations about what it is that an average user wants to actually see on their map and what they do not care about. And that's entirely, it's very functionalist, very kind of objective driven. And what you're talking about is effectively the kind of navigation of a three-dimensional map. You know, you're in the map in a sense. And that map will again, kind of in the ideal, abstract the elements that are more significant, right? That will highlight the elements that are most important to the cognitive operation at hand, be that the military operation, for instance. So I do touch on this as well in the kind of chapter on imaging, where I look at the development of virtual reality and to again kind of show how virtual reality is an extension of the various efforts that have been developed to try and produce kind of environments, perceptual environments, where the cognitive operations of the warfighter can be maximized. And, you know, the airplane cockpits are a natural kind of site for this, because if you're flying an airplane, it's an incredibly complex system. You don't want to have to think very carefully about what is the information you want to present to the operator so that they can focus their mental efforts on what's important and the rest can be stripped back. Obviously that example can be applied much, much more widely, including the ground forces.
Absolutely. And in your previous answer, you talked about that globalized nature of the map, and in the book you talk very much about the Gorgon Stare and that globalized nature of surveillance, which leads me to the next question. So has the success of global surveillance given rise to the hyper-camouflaged suicide bomber who can hide in plain clothes right at the heart of civil society, dissolving any delineation between military and civilian space?
So again, this kind of is towards the tail end of the narrative I developed in a chapter called Hiding. And in this chapter, I turn to what I think is the counterconduct of the logistics of perception. So, you know, we have the functional constituents of the martial gaze, which would be sensing, imaging, and mapping. But then we are, after all, talking about the military activity. We have the adversarial responses to the developments of perception. And these responses, or at least one of them, is the attempts at concealment, to escape or to distract or to mislead perception. And so we have this fundamentally dialectic kind of relationship between perception and concealment that I think is really crucial to this story, because every innovation in perception then leads to countermeasures, which in turn stimulate new measures. So we can look at the history of what we would call camouflage in this light. And camouflage, development camouflage, is completely related to this perception. So modern kind of attempts at camouflage really start in the late 19th century, precisely when the firearms, you know, start becoming, techniques of sniping and so forth become quite effective. And so we have the, you know, the khaki uniforms of the First World War. We have the dazzle camouflage of First World War ships. We have all sorts of efforts that are developed to conceal targets in the visual domain. That, of course, extends beyond to the widest reaches of the electromagnetic spectrum. So now you have to conceal objects from radar. You have to conceal them from infrared. So there's a whole set of techniques of stealth and so forth that are developed. The kind of the endpoint of all this, because I think when we look at this action reaction, it does seem though that although there are various scientific or technological techniques you can develop to counter perception, the advantage might still lie largely with perception, or at least the cost of, you know, stealth technologies seems a lot higher than the development of perception. So take the case of, you know, the B-2 bomber, which is the most advanced stealth aircraft today. You know, that costs about $2 billion a piece. So it's even for a military like the US, it's an incredibly expensive weapon system, which is why they just got to have a couple dozen of them and no more than that. So the obstacles to camouflage, you know, surpassing kind of the efforts of perception seem to be quite high. I mean, there's speculation about metamaterials and other techniques, but at this point, it looks that way. And so I think that then invites thinking about more radical forms of response to camouflage, which I think we are seeing today. And it's what I try to capture with the term of hyper-camouflage. Hyper-camouflage is the logical response, I think, to hyper-visibility. And that's really an attempt to look for not necessarily technological solutions, but much more kind of radical shifts in the understanding of conflict to counter what would otherwise be kind of dramatic vulnerability. So one of the first, I think, areas where we might see this is in the context of the war of terror, where we have a hugely asymmetric conflict, where a superpower is arraigned against non-state actors, and what we see these non-state actors is a willingness to, you know, go beyond any kind of boundaries of civilian and military to actively pursue a radical concealment, which means to blend into the enemy's society, to take on all the trappings of that society, just to ready for a strike at the moment of greatest vulnerability. And you know, that has, of course, implications, because then, as we saw in the war on terror, which is that states and societies become increasingly paranoid about this kind of form of concealment. And this drives calls for greater surveillance of society and what we might call this kind of endomilitarization of peace, where the spaces of peace and war again become more and more difficult to distinguish. Now, I think this kind of question of, or this situation or this aspect of hyper-camouflage is most obvious in the context of the war on terror, but we can also see this bleed into, I think, other forms of conflict, including interstate conflict. For one, you know, one of the manifestations of a global targeting, which would be, you know, the use of drone strikes to target individuals, right? This is a very, obviously, this is on the background of my kind of writing of the book, which is we see this phenomena of individualized targeting conducted against, you know, suspected militants in northern Pakistan or in Yemen or wherever. But we also, at this, you know, in a few years ago, kind of, I think, passed a very important landmark with the killing of General Soleimani, the Iranian general in Iraq, where we see exactly that technique being used against the representative of a state actor. And I think that's just kind of shown how that genie has kind of been let out of the box. And, you know, what we have in the relationship with the United States and Iran is a you know, very asymmetric conflict, and where the Iranians are proceeding with by also all sorts of forms of concealment of their influence, right? The use of proxies and so forth. And then that kind of, I think, opens up in a kind of broader consideration of where the phenomena that has been labeled hybrid war fits into all this. The fact that state actors now have these kind of conflictual relationships, which are very difficult to clearly identify as conditions of peace and war. So I think there's a general phenomena here which has to do with a dissolution of the kind of conventional boundaries of war and peace. And these are both, I think, spatial, in the sense that global targeting means that strikes, military activity can happen at any point in the world. It doesn't need to be contiguous areas. But there's also a dissolution in time. We find it very difficult to delineate the beginning and the end of war. Did the war on terror end? Is it continuing? No one really knows. Is the West at war with Russia since 2022? Or has it been at war since 2014? Who knows? Are we at war with China? Nobody can really answer these questions with any certainty. And that's almost the point. Now, I think this phenomena ties to broader trends than necessarily just global targeting, but I think that is one of the dimensions of it. And this is the question that I think a lot of Western militaries have to ask themselves, that the pursuit of globalized targeting is something that appears on the surface as, you know, very appealing and attractive. It fits with the kind of Western mindset, which is, first of all, you know, privileged technology, but also to target it remotely, to as much as possible minimize risk to our own combatants, and has this promise of, vision of hyper visibility, where we can detect the enemy wherever the enemy is, perhaps even preempt the enemy and strike at it. But I think we have to be wary of the dialectical response that this will bring. You know, that if we dominate that environment, that space, that perception is such that anyone who shows themselves openly in opposition will be destroyed, then we should very much expect a competent adversary to shun that kind of exposure and to look for other ways to advance their interests, to change the rules of the game. And so hyper camouflage, I think, is part one way of kind of capturing that idea, that any space which we overly dominate will inevitably lead to conflict morphing and shifting into other terrains, ones where that advantage won't be as obvious as it is.
And particularly with the case of Afghanistan, it seems that even with the withdrawal of US troops, if you're a member of the Taliban or their leadership, basically you've got a gigantic kill box around you, to use that term, that if you try to foster another Bin Laden, etc., you're going to get taken out, supposedly, you know, as we saw with al-Zawahiri, supposedly targeted in a hotel room and taken out by a drone strike. And talking of drone strikes, the subject on everyone's mind, it seems, these days. With the rise of autonomous drones, do we face the total alienation of all human agency from military perception?
So we're back then to this question of agency, which I think is kind of an underlying theme that runs through the book. There is one particular vignette that I think is quite apposite here that I address in the book. This is a project that was developed during the Second World War by the famous psychologist B.F. Skinner, so-called Project Pigeon. And Skinner, of course, became very famous for some of his experiments on pigeons and on operant conditioning and so forth. It made him kind of perhaps the most eminent psychologist of the 20th century. But before he, became a celebrity, he did his war work. And in his war work, he was already working with pigeons. And one project that he developed was this idea of a pigeon-guided missile, where a conditioned pigeon that had been trained by looking at images of enemy ships and trained to peck at these enemy ships, would be mounted in the head of a missile, and the pigeon would peck at the image of an incoming aircraft, and that would send instructions to the guidance system of the missile, effectively allowing it to home in onto the target, and the pigeon being a kind of kamikaze pigeon, basically. And I think, you know, I find this kind of striking. The system, you know, was never ultimately deployed. Even the military thought it sounded a little bit crazy, but it did actually resurrect it after the Second World War for a little while. But that speaks to me, I think, because I think there's a genuine, the question I would kind of, I find myself asking myself is, you know, are we the pigeon? You know, is this kind of the metaphor here that you know, we are encased in incredibly increasingly sophisticated technical systems which we operate, but also in many ways condition us. And the question of our agency, I think, becomes hugely problematic, and the question of our fate accordingly is at the heart of it. Much of the debate, I think, that has happened in the last 10 years or so around autonomous drones focuses on the idea of killer robots, right? The visions of warfare where the human is entirely sidelined from it. And much as I don't want to discount that scenario, I think that it in some ways misses the more immediate problem that we're facing, which is that I think we're not necessarily going to see humans be supplanted altogether by machines tomorrow. But what we are seeing is a very much more complex landscape in which humans are so deeply immersed in and enmeshed in technical systems that it's not so much that humans have given up all agency, it's just that agency has become now distributed in incredibly complex ways that are very difficult to entangle. Militaries, I think, have to a large extent a vested interest in keeping humans in the loop, if only for accountability, for the ability to find someone who, you know, can bear the responsibility having pushed the button, and so forth, or just simply because militaries don't really like the idea of handing control entirely over to machines. But these humans are in many cases are now increasingly being guided in their decisions. And of course, the development of AI now, notably the command and control and decision aids and so forth, is going to make that increasingly difficult. We'll see humans take decisions, but what that decision actually means, or that ability to decide means, when so much of the battlefield has been mediated, when so many of the options have been narrowed down by technical systems, is going to become an increasingly troubling one. And so I think the problem for us is that it's actually a much more difficult issue than whether we just hand over control or not to the machines, but rather that our very understanding of human autonomy is at stake, and our ability to locate agency is now deeply problematic.
Yeah, that's a really good point about that diffusion of responsibility through the network of sort of cybernetic systems. I wonder, do you feel that with purely autonomous weapons, that there could be an addition to the Geneva Conventions to sort of outlaw that completely autonomous sort of weaponry?
I think that it's a real difficulty with finding appropriate legal recourse to this issue. I know that the people working in this space, you know, have tried to articulate the notion of meaningful control as this kind of yardstick by which systems might be authorized or not. I think that's going to be very difficult for the reasons that I've outlined, which is how do we actually identify what meaningful control means. As to, you know, complete ban, I think that is also very difficult to envisage because of how widespread these technologies are, how difficult it is to delineate, you know, what we might think of as permissible to non-permissible uses. The difficulty of verifying it, because, you know, these are not nuclear missiles, which you can kind of more or less count and, you know, identify according to arms control regimes. identifying lines of code in defense systems, I think I don't quite see how that's going to be easy to achieve. And finally, I think there's a problem that has to do with the kind of, the legal system itself is entirely or very largely premised precisely on some idea of the human subject as this kind of autonomous decision-making entity, which therefore you can hold to account. You made a decision, you freely made that decision, therefore you can be found to be culpable or not of illegal action. I think that's also becoming more and more difficult to sustain in a world where agency is becoming more distributed. So our legal systems themselves, you know, threaten to become something like of a fiction, where, and again, like in militaries might say, well, let's keep someone in the loop. And then when the lawyers come around, we can just say, well, this is the guy who pressed the button. So therefore, you know, you should take it up with him. But they basically become an alibi or you know, a legal fiction effectively, because they don't really tell us how the system took a decision, because that is what's happening. Decisions are being taken by systems, no longer really in a meaningful sense by individuals.
Antoine, my mind's buzzing with 1,000 questions, but you've already given us an hour of your time, and I'm really gracious for that. You know, your answers have been great. I'll restrain myself from asking any more questions. But this has been. I really enjoy how you've gone to that theoretical and technical depth here in these questions. That's what I like, hopefully, about this podcast Hypervosity, is that we go to that level of depth and that level of theoretical abstraction. I like how you've built everything up over the historical record. I really enjoyed speaking to you. I'll put links to your work in the show notes, and I really, you know, advise everyone to check out The Eye of War and Antoine's, you know, other works in these journal articles, which sound absolutely fascinating. Haven't had a chance to look into them, but they sound great. So I just wanted to thank you for giving us an hour of your time this morning, Antoine. Really, really great question answers there. Thank you very much.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Great. Cheers. Stop that recording.